Imam Nawawi's 40 hadith, narrated by Abdullah ibn Umar radiallahu anhumah. Does anybody have it in front of us? We can read the English and the Arabic. Anyone want to read? Either or. You don't have to read both. What are you doing here?
Just had some fun.
Yeah? That's what you said too? Huh? It's good to see you. Does anybody have the hadith? You do?
I got it.
Yeah? Go for it.
On the authority of Abdullah, the son of Umar ibn al-Khattab, the messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, I have been ordered to fight people until they testify that there is no God but Allah, and that Muhammad is the messenger of Allah, and perform the prayers and give the zakah. If they do that, they are protected from me regarding their blood and their properties, unless by the right of Islam, and their accounts will be with Allah, the Exalted.
Jazakallah khair. Can somebody read the Arabic? Here, go for it.
عن ابن عمر رضي الله عنهما أن رسول الله صلى الله عليه وسلم قال أمرت أن أقاتل الناس حتى يشهدوا أن لا إله إلا الله وأن محمدا رسول الله ويقيموا الصلاة ويؤتوا الزكاة فإذا فعلوا ذلك عصموا مني دماءهم وأموالهم إلا بحق الإسلام وحسابهم على الله تعالى.
Last week, we started to get into some of the content of the hadith. And prior to that, we talked about who Abdullah ibn Umar radiallahu anhumah is. Abdullah, the son of Umar ibn al-Khattab, a little bit about his bio. We also had talked about him when we looked at the third hadith in the collection, Bunya al-Islam al-Khams, that he narrates. You can go back and kind of listen to the audio and the video on some of those if you missed it. We also talked about this in the context of a couple of verses from the Quran. Allah tells us that you might dislike something, but there is khair in it for you. Or you might like something, but there is evil in it for you. But here, when we looked at the onset of the hadith last time, we focused on the word umirtu, that the Prophet saying, I was commanded, right? And who commands the messenger of God? It's not any of the companions, it's not anybody in his family, but if he is saying that I was commanded, that command is coming directly from the divine. And the particulars of the hadith giving to us an insight now onto where and how one does what Allah tells us to do in the context of these other ayat that we looked at, that you might dislike something, but there's khair in it for you. You might like something, but there's shar in it for you. That Allah knows best, I'm not the one that knows best, and that it's a God-centric worldview, it's not an ego-centric worldview. People remember, we talked about this last week, yeah. And so we want to get a little bit more into the crux of the hadith to extrapolate from it a little bit of meaning and see where we land by the end of this week so that we can move into something, maybe the next one for next week. And so here, if we start to break it down a little bit more, where the Prophet ﷺ says, "Umirtu an uqatila," this is not the form of the verb that says qatala, but when it exists in this form, it's giving an indication that the participation in something is already something that denotes that there's two sides in it. So there's not like an aggression that's taking place in the sense that I am now overpowering my way into a scenario or becoming provocative in some capacity. But there's an assumption here that in this context, that there are two sides that are kind of going against one another. a hadith like this, when we're looking at it now, it becomes a basis for us to be able to understand why reductive understandings of our tradition become problematic. Somebody could pull a hadith like this and validate and justify all kinds of abhorrent behaviors if they're not understanding it in the context of other texts. So I gave the example, I think last week or 2 weeks ago, of when I went to the Maldives a couple of times. And on one of my visits to the Maldives, when they were transitioning into a democracy, to be a citizen of the Maldives, you have to be Muslim. And their constitution reads that Shafi'i fiqh is what informs their constitutional law. They were heavily influenced at that time, I haven't been in a long time, by a lot of NGOs that were more influenced by kind of outside apparatus from different countries, mostly from Saudi Arabia. There was clashes between like local culture and what it meant to be Maldivian from a little bit more of a reductive approach to Islam that didn't necessarily relate text to context. But one of the things that I mentioned was they took me to visit 12 men who had been imprisoned because they had tried to blow up the Capitol city and the Capitol building. And I said it was the first time I sat face to face with people who they were utilizing Quran as a basis for these types of acts of violence and atrocity, right? May Allah protect us from it. But to have a recognition that you don't want to get to a place where there aren't people who actively think in these ways, and why we want to have an understanding or knowledge as to how these things function, so that we're not in a place also where we engage in apologetics and simultaneously water down our tradition, but we're not also learning it from people who are fundamentally anti-Muslim, and in their strategies, they're able to use our religion against us because we have a low literacy in what it actually says, because it can create a conundrum of issues. You can start to internalize like this feeling of their racism and their supremacy that purposely makes you cast doubt into your tradition and what it is that it actually stands for. Does that make sense? And so through an understanding of this hadith, the word nas here, they would say, has a bunch of different meanings potentially also. One, which most people would say, is that it's in reference particular to the mushrikeen of Mecca, right, when the word nas is being mentioned. There's others that would carve out people who took on the status within a Muslim community that offered them a place within the society so long as they paid the jizya, right? And you'd want to understand the role of the jizya as well, fundamentally for what it was. The way that you and I live in this country, and some of us are citizens and some of us are not. Some of us are here on different visas, right? And we are then afforded different rights and access to different things, but we also get taxed in certain ways differently based off of our residency status and our level of income, etc. This is fundamentally what the jizya is, right? Like you are living within the Muslim community and you're not Muslim. So you're paying a tax that enables like the society to still function, just as you and I function as kind of citizenry in whatever ways that we function. Does that make sense? And you also have an understanding of the word nas, that it's something that essentially is being understood as things are engaged in this mode until there's the opportunity for Muslims to just be able to practice their religion without anybody being in their face, right? So if you come on Wednesdays to the Sirah class that we do, we've been talking a lot about the persecution of the early Muslim community. They're being boycotted, abused, and even killed. There's a woman by the name of Layla who in that early period of revelation, she is going forth to be a part of the group to migrate out of Mecca. And Umar ibn al-Khattab sees her and says, "What are you doing?" And Layla says, "You've made it hard for me and for us to worship our God here, like we're leaving this place." And to her astonishment, Umar says to her, go have peace on your journey. And Layla goes and speaks to her husband, a man by the name of Umar, and recounts what takes place. And he says to her, what are you saying? You sound as if you think Umar ibn al-Khattab will become Muslim. And Layla says, why can't he become Muslim? And he says, know this, the donkey of Umar's father will become Muslim before he does. Like, nobody thought that Umar ibn al-Khattab would become Muslim. Umar's son is narrating this hadith, right? But in the context of that, they can't practice Islam. Like, they just fundamentally are not able to be Muslim. And they're in a place where they're being persecuted, they're being mistreated. You can come in, man, don't worry. Yeah, this is Giuseppe, everybody. And in the broader sense of things, in understanding the universality of this religion and a claim that it's meant to be for people until the end of time, there's going to definitely be things that codify rules of engagement, because you're going to have Muslims who are like the only Muslim in their entire city in the Midwest of the United States. And then you're gonna have Muslims that are Muslim governments. They're gonna need to have criteria that set for them an understanding on how it is that you engage within the prism of theories like just war principles, right? And not things that are just unnecessarily hostile and aggressive or violent for the sake of violence. Does that make sense? So I wanted us to look at a couple of things to help us understand this. If you can open up Surah Anfal, it's the 8th chapter of the Quran, and we'll look at its 61st verse. And people want to pull that up, 861. Does anybody have it? You can read it. Yeah, go for it.
If the enemy is inclined towards peace, make peace with them and put your trust in Allah. Indeed, He alone is all hearing.
Great. Can somebody read the Arabic? Because you can't be scared to read Quran, you know? And you want to understand, like, you're not reading Quran to kind of show somebody that you read Quran amazingly. The hadith literally says that the one who kind of reads it with fluidity, there's ajr for that. But the one who struggles with it, the hadith says, you know, has twice the reward, right? So you want to build a relationship with these verses. And when you read them, it'll stay with you more, do you know? And the act of just verbalizing it outwardly will help make it more concrete. But shaitan doesn't want you to read the Quran. Do you know what I mean? It can't be that like something comes from a good place that's saying, don't read the Quran, right? Like, you know, your heart's not saying like, yeah, don't read it, right? The nafs is telling you not to read it. Do you get what I mean? So can somebody read this verse? Go for it.
I don't know very well, but bear with me. Fa'in jannahu lil-salmi fa'ijna laha wa tawakkal ala Allah innahu huwa al-sami'u al-alim.
Great, mashallah, jazakallah khair. Right? So here, if you are in a place where you now have the opposition and they're inclining towards peace, right? You can see when you read the Arabic language, it derives itself etymologically on terminologies rooted in shared root letters. So when you have this idea of peace, you can see like the derivation is there, salama, of Islam, salam, like these are what gives us an indication also that when you're reading the Arabic, you can find yourself in a place where even if it's not your native language, or you don't know the words, you likely know words that are cognates or have similar derivations that can help you to understand like what is it that it's seeking to evoke, right? So if you're in this place now where the opposition is inclined towards peace, then you choose peace. This is what Surah Al-Anfal is saying here. Do you know what I mean? the hadith has to be understood in relation to what the Quran is telling us. Do you get what I mean? If we can look at Surah Al-Baqarah, it's 190th verse, if people can pull that up.
Which verse?
190 of Surah Baqarah. Does anybody have it? Let's get somebody else to read too, just to share the Azur. Yeah, go for it.
وَقَاتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ الَّذِينَ يُقَاتِلُونَكُمْ وَلَا تَعْدُوا إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يُحِبُّ الْمُعْتَدِينَ.
Great. Can somebody read the translation?
Fight in the way of Allah those who fight against you, but do not transgress. Indeed, Allah does not like transgressors.
So what does it mean, right? And when you look at it in the context now of these verses together, these hadith together, and we're putting them all together, principally you want to understand that it's not a religion that just says, here's this one verse, this is what this means. But these texts have to speak to one another. The Prophet ﷺ, right? كان قرآن يمشي, that he is the Qur'an walking, that he is the personification of the Qur'an. If you take a hadith and you isolate it and you just look at it in a vacuum, then that's just going to yield you what it is that it yields you. But if you don't contextualize hadith, if you don't see like who is he saying it to, when is it being said, like why is it being said, the verses of the Qur'an, like what are the verses before and after, how does it relate to other verses of the Qur'an, you can get to a place where you reduce the meaning of it to something that becomes simplistic and doesn't allow for it to get to its depths. And so there are guidelines that we can understand in relation to hadith like this that also principally for people like you and I necessitate us getting to a place where we see how this is like an entire book and it's an entire corpus of tradition that is the hadith. The example that we utilize in the seerah class that relates like the hadith to the seerah is that if you have individual narrations of a hadith and understand its relationship to the seerah on a whole, you can liken it to like a puzzle that has 10,000 pieces to it. And if somebody could connect like three of those pieces, or say, I don't know how to put them together, but it looks like these ones make up this corner, you wouldn't say that that person's an expert in that puzzle. And the hadith work the same way. If somebody knows one hadith or two hadith, or has like this kind of breakdown, they're not putting the entire puzzle together, right? And when you put the entire puzzle together, this 10,000 piece puzzle, it creates a picture. That's the entire life of the Prophet of God. You see? And so you reading one verse, the translation thereof, or anything, you can then turn a book into whatever it is that you want. But you're looking at Allah's book, and the hadith and the Prophet's example is just an explanation of Allah's book. And Allah is saying, if the opposition is inclined towards peace, then you choose peace, right? That's what the verse says. We just read it together, you know? If you're engaged in any of this, then the guideline is coming. You can't transgress in some way. You still have boundaries. You still have limitations. And you find this in the hadith, like quite often. The Prophet ﷺ, he tells like people, you do not harm like women or children. You don't harm monks. You don't harm a bunch of things. And then Abu Bakr, he has very famously a saying where he codifies this into guidelines and principles of things that you also don't engage in when you're in an act of war, an act of kind of fighting in some capacity. And before we look at that, we want to think about this. In Islamic law, it's not that like the individual just has the capacity to go and declare anything. When you look at the hadith in its entirety, it gives to us this indication. And so here, as we read it, and until they establish the salah and pay the zakat, and if they do that, then they will have gained protection from me for their lives and property, unless they commit acts that are punishable in Islam, like the had punishments. Again, the Prophet is saying, I got to do what Allah is telling me to do. But the capacity there still fits within the confines of what is like the religion calling us towards. And it all attaches itself to this this like link that says, it's all fundamentally coming from God. Like it's coming from the divine. The Prophet sets the condition that says we can do this across the board, except the carve out is when Allah says that there's transgressions that have to be dealt with in a certain capacity. The implementation of it is not done now by individuals, but there are systems in place, structures in place that then allow for something to be decided upon. Within certain locales, those things might exist in some capacity. On a state level, it might exist in some capacity. But none of us in this room are going to be in a place where individually we can say, we're going to now go out, and just by virtue of a hadith, we're going to implement certain injunctions that cannot be implemented in the absence of certain systems and structures. That's just not how Islam has ever functioned across the board. And there's going to be historical incidents that people can take to validate and justify, still yet again, in ways that are not conducive to what the fundamental ethos is of some of these things. So how do we start to make sense of it? Well, like being on the defensive is something that becomes a valid mode of engagement of this type of action. So if somebody came into your house and started to like fight your family, you don't just sit back and say, you know what, like I'm not supposed to do anything religiously. No, what are you going to do, right? Like if I came into your house and, I mean, your brother's a lot bigger than me, right? But if, you know, I somehow started like beating down your brother, would you not stop me from doing that, right? You would. So this is one scenario. The scenario that deems itself to build itself off of this, if there is a recognition that something has to happen preemptively because you know something is going to come at you also. So in the context of what's taking place in a prophetic era, they know that there are empires that just are in a place where they glorify these things. We don't live in any different of a time. You live in a country that is built off of the glorification of war. May Allah protect us from ever putting that glorification in our hearts. It's sickening. Entire industries are built off of military industrial complexes, prison industrial complexes, weapon manufacturing. Insane what it is in order to implement that, right? Like nobody creates a bullet because they don't want it to be fired, right? What do they think they're gonna do when they make the bullet, or when they make the bomb, or when they make the missile? And how do they get people to rally behind this? Is through the glorification of this heinous, atrocious thing that is war. And you see the imagery right now, right? Because there are apparatus that have been created that historically were not created that allowed for the victor to always determine what was actually historically accurate. You can read a book, I forget who wrote it, it's from some time ago, it's called The Killing of History, and it entirely is premised off of this idea that the people who win get to decide what history is written. And there's not like objective understanding. They're writing it based off of what it is they want people to know. And so they don't want people to know what is the actual realities of things like war. And now when you have social media apparatus that enable you to understand it, this religion is not a religion that glorifies any of this nonsense. It just fundamentally doesn't. And the hypocrisy of nations that have built themselves off of the glorification of things like this, because they fundamentally could care less about anyone other than themselves. You can't now start to adopt the attitudes of those that are other than the prophetic way of being. In the prophetic era and thereafter, you have entire empires that also just like lust for blood. It's insane. Like, who thinks of the idea of throwing slaves to lions? This is what they do in Colosseums in Rome, right? The notion of like crucifying somebody. How do you even wake up and think about that? I'm going to nail you to two planks of wood, right? These are things that we know historically take place. Human capacity has this. So at an institutional level, you want to be able to think out what's happening as people grow clout. In the Meccan society, they don't want Islam to exist. The Prophet establishes his Medina and he comes back into Mecca, and does he do anything other than say everybody's forgiven? There's no bloodshed at the taking back of Mecca. But they also don't live in a bubble, and there's people that are engaged in trade and everything else. Abu Bakr radiallahu anh, under his caliphate, it's not growth as much as there is during Umar's caliphate. And people in the world at that time, just like people in the world right now, they don't want to lose their power. They want to retain it. So these guys, centuries ago, are dealing now with Persian empires, Roman empires. They know that they're going to come to create war and conflict. They know that these things are going to happen. And so as people are trying to do this, not in a vacuum, it's not exerted in like, what is it that's going to give me the most money or the most wealth or the most land? They're trying to determine, what does Allah want from us in all of this? What's the best course of action for us to undertake as we also now grow in these ways and we have responsibility to community and to people? And these verses and these hadith are setting still those guidelines because they're meant to be timeless. People inclined towards peace, then you choose peace. That's just what you do. You're going to engage in these actions, then you understand that you can't transgress. There's hadith where there are battles that take place and the Prophet comes upon the corpse of a woman and he says to his people, how did this happen? She's not a combatant. You're not supposed to do this to women. Somebody chooses to join the ranks of the opposition, then that's different. But the default is women, children, people who are religious figures, as much as everything else that you know is said, and we'll look at it in more detail in a couple of minutes, about like vegetation and monasteries and places of worship and whatever else. It's not like a free-for-all. There are confining ethics in this way. And the inclination is towards building a state that is harmonious in its existence, that allows for people to be who they are, but as long as who they are doesn't mean that they get to like kill you and keep you from worshiping God in the way that you are allowed to worship God. And when that becomes the norm, then that's the norm. Does that make sense? Okay. What I'd like for us to do, just because more people have trickled in now, if you can turn to the persons next to you, what are you taking away so far? What is it bringing up for you? What's coming up? And then we'll come back and discuss a little bit. But go ahead.
I'm on you.
Yeah, one time. Where, how did you come also?
Oh, we had it.
I think it's hilarious.
What capacity do you work in?
So the Facebook live stream is working, the YouTube is working, Instagram. The only one that's not working is your profile. Do you want me to log you in again?
No, that's fine. Okay. Yeah, thanks, man. Okay, so what are some of the things that are coming up for people? What are we discussing? Yeah, go ahead.
We had some questions or points of curiosity. The first was about, you talk about expertise and how we need to have a picture of the puzzle as a whole. That makes it kind of challenging in looking to who can have this type of expertise and convey the puzzle as a whole to someone learning. And then the second point was about, you brought up institutions serving as kind of guidance for how war is meant to be conducted. And then we were discussing countries, Muslim countries today, that themselves engage in transgressions and violence. And like how you understand, how you might understand that.
Okay. What else do people talk about? We'll talk about that, but what else do people discuss?
And we also discussed about how it is dangerous to take certain things out of context. I'm repeating myself, but I said something along, for example, I hate to use this example, but Taliban, let's say, they use Islam as a tool to drive, to oppress other people around their own countrymates, or their own brothers and sisters. And it can be very dangerous because it's usually it's ego-driven and not God-driven. Yeah.
Great. Other thoughts?
I'm the
honeymoon's going to
represent
this. You look so excited, dude. Yeah.
We were just talking about sort of having the ability in your faith to understand. Sometimes you might not understand things the right way, but also really try to understand, what your interpretation of Islam means to you and how you can sort of be as true to your faith as possible, and how rulings serve for Islam really sort of have led in the connection serve every other part of your life as well. So what you learn in one sense is a lot of times has applications as well.
Great. Any other thoughts? So when we're talking about who it is that you can engage, your pedagogies around learning are going to be varied from people to people, right? Some of us are more visual learners. Some of us learn better by hearing something or reading something. But that aspect of learning also requires us to think about methodologies implemented by the ones that we're taking from. Do you know what I mean? And like anyone can be Muslim if they want to be. And we live at a time where it's actually not hard to access information at all, but the ability to distill information, like how do you know? How do you know when you go online and you Google something that the website that you're reading from about Islam was made by somebody who's actually Muslim? How do you know you're not reading something that was funded by somebody who wants you to read that and has optimized the search results to come to their site and at the end makes you want to doubt Islam or makes you want to hate Islam? How do you know? And when you want to learn most things that have relevancy to critical parts, we don't learn Islam in a vacuum. You're not learning Islam because you inherited it from your parents, and you're not engaging Islam as a sociological identity variable alone. Potentially, you might be doing that, but you want to align it to the idea that says that through this and its implementation, one has the potential yield for inward contentment and a rendering of a heart that's sovereign, a theology that's robust that helps us to understand we're working for something bigger than the confines of this world. And it's not just a set of exercises or rituals, like as an ends, there are means to something, do you know? You can't learn Islam by listening to just audio files and videos of talks that were given to audiences that you weren't even sitting in. It's very purposely meant to be a heart-to-heart interaction. The Prophet alayhi salam, this is what he did, right? He didn't have mass technology that he was engaged in, but he was literally building relationships with people one-on-one and individually. You want to think of criteria of who like a teacher is. There's a lot of different lists that you can look at. In the context of this, I was saying this earlier in my office, right? Like when Imam Ghazali has like lists of like who you should take as a teacher, one of the things that he tells people to be wary of are people who are religious teachers that work for like governments, you know, because it creates too much of an overlap with ideologies that have agendas attached to them in ways that now can manipulate religions and senses that doesn't make any sense, right? But at the same level, like this isn't like, hey man, can I wipe over my socks or not? You know, like what's a miswak? How do you make wudu? This is like something that is important to understand, that a person who knows a handful of hadith or quote unquote looks Muslim is not necessarily going to be the one that is going to explain to you like Islamic codes of ethics on engagement on a military level or historically what these things mean or how it is that one implements and executes them. And at the same level, you don't want somebody who waters it down and says like there's no sense of this within Islam, because there is. The whole idea of it is to implement mechanisms that enable people to have justice, to defend populations that are oppressed. And you need some of these things, right? To say that we've lived in a world historically that has not had tyrants in them, right? Every generation has its own pharaohs, like they do. We don't learn these stories because they're meant to just be stories, but to understand like Pharaonic worldviews are very real things. And you have individuals that when they are given power, they can be people like Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, or they can be people who are like Nimrut, right? And why do we understand it? So that in the context of our time, we know where we stand in relation to some of these things. Do you know? Sometimes there's not two sides to stories. Sometimes there is no neutrality on things. But our tradition creates guidelines. If you can't understand why there needs to be guidelines, look at the world right now that is indiscriminately engaged in acts where they're validating and justifying in numerous parts of the world, including most critically a lot that a lot of us have probably plugged into over the course of the last year of what's happening on the ground in Palestine, right? And how do you get to a place fundamentally where people don't care? And you might be able to say, well, like, doesn't everybody think it's wrong to kill children? Why does somebody have to verbalize the idea that killing children is bad? They've killed so many children, right? And they could fundamentally care less. And there's people who get up every day and justify it as collateral damage or necessary this, or they'll invert narratives and say that you are the reason that we are killing your children. How does it make any sense? This is why it's important to know that the Prophet says to Osama bin Zayd, when we talked about it last week, the man who says the Shahada as they're engaged in the battle, أَقَتَلْتُهُ بَعْدَمَا قَالَ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهِ. Did you kill him after he said, La ilaha illallah? Lima qataltahu? Why did you kill him? This is why it's important to know that the Prophet of God sees the woman in the aftermath of the battle who is a non-combatant that is killed and questions, like, why did you do this? There's repercussions of accountability in terms of standing in front of God. Somebody is going to have to own up for responsibility of doing why what shouldn't have been done was done. And it's not about creating like retributive anger, right? This is not the type of anger you want that's toxic in your heart, vengeful anger, but righteous anger is different from vengeful anger. You know, you should be angered by oppression and inequity. But when you look at the world right now that has more refugees than at any other time, you look at the world right now that like humanity has evolved weaponry to such like a grotesque level of utilizing its spiritual gift of intellect to think out how they can kill other human beings in the ways that they can kill them. Why wouldn't our religion say, here are the ways that you have to operate even in this type of situation? Even when you're out there, there are guidelines that you have to follow. Do you get what I'm saying? There's no like free-for-all. You just do whatever you want without any consequences whatsoever. Does that make sense? Abu Bakr radiallahu an, he says very famously, 10 rules for a Muslim army. And so he says, O people, I charge you with 10 rules. Learn them well. Stop, O people, that I may give you 10 rules for your guidance in the battlefield. Do not commit treachery or deviate from the right path. You must not mutilate dead bodies, neither kill a child, nor a woman, nor an aged person. Bring no harm to the trees, nor burn them with fire, especially those which are fruitful. Slay not any of the enemy's flock, save for your own food. You are likely to pass by people who have devoted their lives to monastic services. Leave them alone. The instructions in and of themselves are now creating criteria for engagement. Sharia applies to every facet of life, and it's not in a vacuum. There are maqasid to the Sharia. There are objectives to Islamic law. What is the foresight to telling a community of soldiers that don't destroy vegetations, especially the ones that bear fruit? And this is why you got to think about what you know of the Prophet's life, the hadith, the seerah, and not think about it as stories, but how they inform things, right? The Prophet goes to Taif, and the people abuse him in Taif. Aisha radiallahu ta'ala anha asks him, what's the hardest day in your life? He doesn't say, Aisha, we don't complain. He says, Taif. Taif was the hardest thing he ever had to go through. And this is after he's seen his people be beaten and abused and persecuted. He goes to Taif thinking they're going to welcome him in. And not only does that not happen, but the chieftains of the tribes command their servants and children to run the Prophet out of the ground. They abuse him. It's not like for minutes. This takes place over a long period of time. He's broken inwardly. His blessed feet, they say, has so much blood coming out of it that what he's wearing on his feet become hardened to the soles of his feet because of the excessive amount of blood. And when he gets to the outskirts, there's a beautiful dua that he turns to Allah with, that you should read and really ponder and reflect upon. But at the culmination of all of this, when he's turning to God, he's asking, have you forsaken me? And he's like, if all of this is like happening to me, but you're still not displeased with me, you're pleased with me, then I'm good. That's the crux of the dua that he makes. But for this conversation, an angel presents himself. Ya Muhammad, I'm the angel of the mountains that surround this city. If you command me to do so, I will crush these people in it. And the Prophet doesn't say, yes, go seek vengeance on my behalf and retribution. He says, no, let them be. Perhaps the generations that will come after, they will understand. If you are engaged in a war in your own land, would it make sense to burn down your own trees? No, right? So likely here, these are guidelines that are also about you're going into somebody else's neighborhood. Don't burn down their trees. Why? Because there's going to be people who are not these people. They're going to come after. They might understand differently. There's always elements of foresight to leadership in our tradition, visionary understandings. If this was a religion that was about, God forbid, obliterating people who practice other ways of life, why is Abu Bakr telling his soldiers, reiterating what the Prophet has said, to not like kill monks? Literally, this is what he said. You are likely to pass by people who have devoted their lives to monastic services. Leave them alone. Why? If it was meant to be a supremacist tradition that was about the annihilation and extinction of people, why wouldn't it be that the first thing that they say go and engage in? And you see people, right? If I had it right now, my laptop got messed up, so I'm using a different one. I would show you like images of people that I met from Myanmar, Rohingya. You saw many of you, like, because a lot of you didn't see that. Some of you might have been here in 2017, 2018. Was anybody here in 2017, 2018 at the IC? Did you ever see the pictures from when I went to visit the camps in Myanmar and Bangladesh? These were refugees that I sat with between two Eids in 2017 and 2018. I went as close as to Myanmar as I could. They wouldn't let me in because the relief agencies I was with, they said anything that looks Muslim is being burned at the border. I got to the Naf River. I could see into Myanmar like clouds of smoke in the middle of the day because they're setting everything on fire. There wasn't a refugee that I met who couldn't tell me that they hadn't seen loved ones burned alive in front of their eyes. How can you have a religion that does not have ethics to engagement? It's going to still tell you at the end of the day how it is that you engage in this way that demonstrates a sense of dignity, both for the other, but what self-dignity means. That as a Muslim, you are not meant to be people who go out and just engage in these kind of indiscriminate acts of transgression and violence. Here, like Abu Bakr is saying, you do not mutilate dead bodies. Why? There's instances in the hadith where people come and they offer the Prophet ﷺ like tons of money to be able to get the corpses of their loved ones back. And the Prophet just gives it to them. He says, I'm not in the business of selling bodies. Why? Why would you not want somebody to have the body of their loved one back? And what pleasure would you derive from like mutilating? And then you think, like when people, you read their accounts of how it is that they're recognizing the loved ones that they've lost in Gaza. It's crazy that a human can do that to another human. How do you get to this place? Do not commit treachery is an important injunction in our codes of engagement. You don't enter into treaties to pretend like you didn't make a treaty. So if you made a treaty, you honor the rights of the treaty. It's not that we would sit down and broker a treaty for the sole purpose of then kind of breaking it. If someone else broke the treaty, well, then that's different, right? This is what happens at Hudaybiyah. You know, the Meccans break the treaty, not the Muslims break the treaty. But the Prophet honors the rights of the treaty. He goes back, they slaughter their animals, they don't have Hajj, people don't want it, right? Alasna bil Muslimin wa alaysu bil Mushrikeen. Umar says to the Prophet, he says to Abu Bakr, aren't we the Muslims and aren't they the Mushrik? Like, why are we making these deals? What's going on? Because we are people of integrity. We treat people based off of who we are, not who they are. And it applies even in these types of contexts. Does this make sense? Neither kill a child, nor a woman, nor an aged person. Bring no harm to the trees, nor burn them with fire, especially those which are fruitful. Slay not the enemy's flocks, save for your own food. When you look in books of fiqh, there's interesting discussions on animate objects, inanimate, like creation, and animate creation, right? And what does it mean to still honor the rights of these things? When Allah says, "Inni ja'ilun fil ardi khalifa," that I'm going to send onto the earth a khalifa, the angels say, right? Qalu, they say, "Atajalu fiha man yufsidu fiha wa yasfiku dima," that you are going to send those who create facade on the earth, right? Facade al-ard is what is being defined here, what constitutes facade of the earth. You're not meant to be Muslims, people who like destroy the earth and the trees and the fruits and all of these things. وَيَسْفِكُ الدِّمَا, and they just shed blood. You're not like, that's not who you are. You're not meant to be those things. You're just not like predatorial for this. Even if you look at animals in creation, you don't see lions that walk around and they just kill other animals for the sake of killing them. That's just not a thing. There's a certain like sense of decorum and majesty that exists there. Do you get what I mean? And it has to be applicable because it's going to exist in numerous frames and modes. And these things are just like the tip of numerous hadith and other verses of the Quran that we can understand and draw upon that sets for us criteria. Now when we get to like the second part of this question, well, like what's happening with Muslims who are doing these things, right? Muslims are killing Muslims. They're engaged in actions of transgressions against people of different backgrounds. Where does the disconnect come in? Religion can be very easily a mechanism of empowerment, but can also be very easily weaponized to get people to reach objectives and goals of demographics that don't have otherworldly intentions in mind. And you want to be mindful of that so that you are not getting caught in a place too where your approach of religion is simply rooted with those whose intention is to have materialistic gain from religion. And it can be very empowering. You go to demographics who are traditionally oppressed, held down, persecuted, and say, you know the way that you are going to get yours? Here's a gun that we put in your hand. Here's this that we put in your hand. You want to create violence. Do you think that people care about the number of people that they are giving access to killing within minority populations? No. You have weaponry that gets created purposefully that it looks like toys. You have guns that are sold that like are able to have no fingerprints on them. Who comes up with these things? And if we don't know our religion and ethics that go into it, it creates like a conundrum and all kinds of inward angst. Like even in a lot of what we see, it's horrendous that much more because there's no real honor to it. There's no sense of dignity that's rooted in any of it. They've stopped recognizing that there's humans that are on the other end. And the absence of that now enables there to be like indiscriminate violence. And Muslims who seek validation from systems of oppression. They believe that their sense of self-worth is based off of how much wealth they have and how much money that they have, or like what colonization purposely seeks to do is get you to believe that you're only acceptable when the colonizer approves of your way of life. Why wouldn't they also just start killing people? Who's creating a famine in Yemen? Who's doing that? Right? Where is that coming from? And so you leave behind the sunnah outwardly and inwardly, or you allow for people to trivialize and teach in reductive ways. It can then validate and justify things that don't make any sense. And then when you got like to, you know, use like a coined phrase, scholars for dollars, who are willing to take like seats and have recognitions and titles that then enable them to justify things that are unjustifiable. And you're like, well, like what version of Islam do I offer back to the world? A world right now that fundamentally is watching babies die. Do you get what I mean? And when you look at this now, as we go through the rest of this hadith, the Prophet ﷺ, he talks about the inviolability of humanity here. It's not the only time that this phrase is utilized, right? Dima'ukum wa amwalakum, like literally their blood and their property, their wealth, it becomes inviolable. We're going to be reaching like the days of Dhul Hijjah soon. May Allah make us from those who take benefit from them. The day of Arafah, like the farewell khutbah of the Prophet alayhi salam, this is like what he says, right? He stands in front of the companions and they're in the place of Arafah. He points in the direction of Mecca. Ayubaladan hadha, like what city is this? They know it's the city of Mecca, right? But they're silent. And people will explain their silence as deference towards the Prophet of God, right? They don't want to come across as disrespectful. They want him to be able to answer the question. And there's also, like what our teachers tell us, is that if the Prophet said, this isn't called Mecca anymore, this isn't Arafah anymore, they just say it's whatever it is that he says that it is, right? Ayu baladin hadha, what city is this? Ayu shahrin hadha, what month is this? They know it's the month of Dhul Hijjah. Right? They're in the month of Dhul Hijjah. They're aware of it. Again, they're silent. Is this not the month of Dhul Hijjah, he says? And he says, Ayu yomin hadha, that what day is this? And they know it's the day of Arafah, the ninth of Dhul Hijjah, the day that the Prophet is going to give this farewell khutbah. And again, they're not responding. And if you look at the last khutbah of the Prophet, one of the statements that are there, O people, just as you regard this month, this day, this city is sacred, so too regard the life and property of every Muslim as a sacred trust. You have a recognition of what it means to have respect for life. The farewell khutbah of the Prophet is something that we should go through in deep detail, because embedded within it is pretty much the root of every vice that plagues humanity right now. Racism, financial injustice, violence of all kinds, how it is that women get mistreated. I mean, you could go through everything that fundamentally becomes the base of all of this stuff, and that the last opportunity of a khutbah and the entirety of 120,000 companions in front of him, the Prophet chooses to talk about this instead of anything else. And he's saying this day of Arafah, which is arguably the most sacred day in the calendar, in the month of Dhul Hijjah, the month of Hajj, the 10 best days in the calendar, in the place of Arafah, in the confines of the city of Mecca, the most barakah filled place in the world, arguably, that more auspicious than this day and this month in this place is how it is that you treat one another, how it is that you provide care to each other. Do you see what I mean? And that becomes the basis of like these ethics of engagement. And then he says, if they transgress those things, their reckoning will be with Allah. It's always interesting to see at various junctures in the prophetic tradition that the prophet alludes to judgment fundamentally being with God at the end of all things, right? He's not categorically saying somebody who leaves behind this or does that, they're definitely going to hell. Do you know? Because he is not Malik Yawm al-Din. Allah is. You and I are also not. Right? What does he say to Osama bin Zayd in the hadith we looked at last week? Like, did you open up his chest and look into his heart to see that this is why he said what he said? Right? After the man in the battle says, La ilaha illallah, and Osama bin Zayd takes his life. So what I'd like for us to do, just because we're kind of coming to closer to the building closing, the building's going to close at 8 today. So for those who are not aware, we're going to wrap up around 7:30 so people have time to get to a place you can pray Maghrib. Don't stay in the building past 8 o'clock. It costs us $400 an hour to keep the building open past its hours of operation, right? So when you're heading out and you like to hang out in the lounge and talk to everybody, just go stand outside and talk to each other, right? It's the same thing. It's not that much of a problem. But if you could turn the persons next to you, what are some of the things you're taking away from today's conversation? What is it bringing up for you? And then we'll come back and discuss, and we'll go from there.
I'm going to go to the next one.
Okay, so what are some of the things we're taking away from today's conversation? What's coming up for people? What did we discuss? Anyway, maybe we get a couple people before we wrap up. Yeah.
We were talking a little bit about, like, I've had the privilege of visiting Palestine, and one thing that hit me over and over when I was there was just, like, how hurt people. Like, my brain couldn't wrap my head around, like, experiencing a tragedy or a genocide or a Holocaust and or knowing about it generations in your family and then literally enacting it and what the strategies around that. And it's something you said a lot earlier, but we were just talking about, like, what are the rules of warfare? Like, how do you, what are the tools of, like, justifying those sorts of things? Like, because obviously from an outside, well, not obviously, from an outsider's point of view, it's not, like, I literally can't conceive of it. And what are the tools that help enable those sorts of things? So, like, fear is obviously a tool. Scarcity mindset is also a tool. That's a little gist of what.
Yeah. And how could those guidelines come from any individual human being? Right? When we think about moral relativism in a scenario that would be the most dangerous of scenarios, a divine system that claims universality the way Islam does, and also claims itself to be a final testament, applicable to people in any place, in any walk of life, in any background, how could, other than God, who is the creator of all creation, be the one to determine something like this? Like, only it can come from Allah, right? Because what persons wouldn't then interject some aspect of inequity or an injustice into, like, those guidelines? Do you know what I mean? And that's why these verses are important to understand. If they incline towards peace, you choose peace. That's just what it is. Literally, the man is fighting Osama ibn Zayd in the battlefield, and he says, La ilaha illallah, and the Prophet tells Osama ibn Zayd, you shouldn't have done that to him. Do you know? These are the guidelines coming from the divine. You see? What else do we talk about? Yeah.
So in the conversation that we had, we kind of summarized everything. Kevin narrowed it down to that the true judge of everything is Allah. Even as you think about, like, some of the rules of engagement and, you know, the inclining toward peace, and, you know, so if anybody was thinking tactfully in a war, like, those could be called weaknesses, you know, and a disadvantage toward the ultimate, what people might call victory. But then you understand that we do those things because Allah is the one who told us to. And it becomes less of a, we're trying to win this, and more of a, I mean, this, this, I guess the greater success is just doing what Allah says. And then it's not about what we see, what we feel, what we want. It's about loving the judge and trusting that. And then following the rules because of it.
Yeah. And it's like, if you see Dr. Farhan Aziz, has a video up. He went to like to Gaza to provide medical support, and he was recounting how they, you know, went into homes and were given some like guidelines, instructions. But there's like purposely household items, like cans of food, that were left behind in homes that were freestanding still, that are like actually like bombs. Do you know who's gonna pick that up? It's not gonna be a soldier. Right? How do you get to that place? Do you know what I mean? And you'd want to be able to think how people take advantage of an absence of literacy of our tradition and tell us what our religion is when it's not what they're saying. And if you were to look at systems that are in place from the Quran and Hadith in this mode of engagement, that the way Allah tells us to do it, if it needs to be done, and it's better to avoid it at all costs. But if it has to be done, which in certain situations is inevitable, like these are the guidelines that you work it through, it's like categorically better than how any human does any of this stuff. Do you know? Right? Like when we gave the example of the Prophet coming into Mecca, and the people of Mecca know he's coming, they're getting ready. And we said, how many people can be around a fire, right? You said 10, right? Remember last week, right? What the Prophet does at the outskirts of the city of Mecca is that he tells individuals, one person each, to each build a fire. So when the people of Mecca are seeing them coming in, it looks like there's 10 times as many people, because psychologically they're thinking for every fire, there's 10 people around it, not one person around every fire. The Prophet wants to make it seem like they have a massive more number of people because he wants to avoid any type of fighting. That's like the crux of it. Do you see what I mean? And so you want to ponder on some of these things in the context of like the text and what it says to be like, yeah, like if it's got to be done, then this is the way to go about it, right? And at whatever juncture there's an opportunity to bring a stop to it, then you bring a stop to it. You see? Okay. So we're going to take a pause. Next week, we might talk a little bit more about this, but then get into Hadith number 9. And people want to read that a little bit. Tomorrow, Dr. Murmur will be doing his halakha, and we'll do the Sira halakha on Wednesday. And Sheikh Faz will be doing his halakha on Thursday. And I think going into next week, we'll know by Friday night when the month of Dhul-Hijjah is starting. And so, if, you know, you came to Jummah the last couple of weeks, we talked about it a little bit. These are like 10 really important days, these 10 days of Dhul-Hijjah. So if you have capacity in the first 9 days, you want to try to fast in those days. The Hadith says that in these 10 days, righteous actions are, you know, better in these 10 days than any other 10 days. So volunteerism, charity, whatever, it's categorically different from Ramadan, because the fast of Ramadan is an obligation, right? So not having to do something becomes an inroad to inculcating like love and inward transformation that much more. You're not doing because you have to do it, you're doing because you want to do it, right? There's no requirement to do it. If you can't do every day, like at a minimum, try to fast on the 9th of Dhul-Hijjah, the day of Arafah. And we'll have iftar here on that day. The 9th of Dhul-Hijjah will either be Saturday the 15th or Sunday the 16th. So if you want to block out those, and Eid is going to either be then subsequently Sunday the 16th or Monday the 17th. And we're anticipating being in the park and brunch and whatever else. But utilize like those 10 days and start thinking about it as best as you can. Last night, we put out an email about a toy drive that we host annually. I think it's the 9th time we're doing it. This toy drive brings toys to children on the day of Eid, who are pediatric patients in hospitals, 25 states in the country. And this year we also added Heal Palestine, which brings children from Gaza right now who have medical needs to the states. And we're working also with the Sudanese American Physicians Association. And there's a hospital in Sudan that they're going to be taking toys to at the end of this week. So I don't know if they're going to do a second round. I think they might be. But in particular, if you want to contribute to the shipment going to Sudan this week, then try to make some contributions to that now. And it's not to undermine. I know people are at different levels of wealth. Some of these toys cost like $2, right? But go a long way for a sick kid who, imagine being like in the hospital on the day of Eid. You know what that's like, right? And so if you could help spread the word on that, we're going to probably next week put out a campaign that we do for the Udhiyah, the Qurbani, the ritual slaughter that's attached to the Abrahamic narrative around the days of Eid. And similar to last few years, we're going to give opportunities for people to contribute to people in the United States, but also multiple countries around the world. There's just a lot of people who don't have food, right? And so you want to be able to give what you can. If you have questions about it, we'll put it in the email, right? There's some opinions that say the Udhiyah is wajib on every adult Muslim who has passed a certain threshold of wealth, right? About 612 grams of silver is the basis of that threshold. And there's others who say it's a sunnah mu'akkada, so every person doesn't have to do it. It's a recommended act. Doing one is a minimum, though. You could do like much more than that. Do you know what I mean? But if you could help us spread the words on those things as well, you know, I'll go a long way in helping a lot of people, inshallah. Great. So let's take a pause. If people want to just help put the chairs back against the wall, and we'll see everybody next week, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum.